This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This Scotland Outdoors podcast from BBC Radio Scotland.
How you doing, Mark?
I'm all right. That was comparatively straightforward.
So far, so good.
Is it just the one you're shifting?
One, and then we're bringing another four out of that shed, and they're going up to the other shed up there. So.
Right, okay.
We'll just shift this gate, right?
Oh, no problem.
How you doing?
I'm absolutely fine. Fine. This is the nicest day I've seen in about a fortnight.
Oh, jinx, it's been unbelievable, isn't it?
Terrible. Not? Absolutely terrible weather.
It's been shocking.
As you'll have gathered, I arrived at Martin Kennedy's farm on a hill above Aberfeldy in Perthshire just as he and his daughter were moving cattle around. Now, you may think that conversations about the weather are pretty par for the course amongst farmers, but they live and die by it. The climate, however, is increasingly the main topic for everyone as we experience more frequent and more extreme weather events. Martin's not only a working farmer. He's also president of the National Farmers Union of Scotland, so he's across all of the issues which are currently affecting the industry. I'm Mark Stephen, and in this edition of Scotland Outdoors, Martin shows me around the farm and we discuss the things that matter to him, including the management of rivers, the reintroduction of beavers, how to get young people into the industry, and ultimately why he thinks farming is the best job in the world. Let's get back to those noisy cattle.
We've just spayed the Highland calves, that's why they're making a bit of noise, so we just brought them down yesterday and split them off, and the cows are back out the hill again, so we'll go and see them in a wee bit. The hens are a wee bit of noise. The heifer calves off the Highlanders, which are white bred shorthorn cross, they get sold to a chap that buys them for cows, for outwinter cows, and then we're now finishing the bullock calves ourselves. We're selling quite a few of them in boxes actually. So
they are sufficiently hairy.
Yes.
To be able to cope with just about any weather, I would say.
Absolutely. Well, given the weather we've just had in the last sort of 3 months, they're looking bra and healthy, like, you know, they're bra cheery calves, so it just shows you they can actually cope with that weather outside. But it's just now to give the cows a break as well.
How high up are we here?
We're 820 feet here, and we go to 2,500 feet, so it's challenging sometimes. Yeah.
This is just a general observation. It is hell of a tidy ground. I mean, it looks really well kept.
That doesn't happen itself. It's a lot of work to look after the ground, like, and that's what we do. Farmers and crofters do that throughout the country. You know, it's in our interest to keep it tidy, and you're seeing it at its worst, to be honest. You're seeing it in the turn of the year. If you see it in sort of May, June, when you see everything that's going about, and we're blessed with oyster catchers, curlews, you know, lapwings are in abundance up the hill, which is tremendous in the summer. But then that's because we're managing the landscape, where grazing management's so important to ground nesting birds, and we're actually on a shooting estate, so the predators are under control. So it's the combination of the both that brings the biodiversity.
It's lovely seeing your beasts, but I suspect we're probably going to have to go somewhere a bit quieter to carry on this conversation.
Yeah, absolutely, we can do that. No bother, we'll do that, Mark. Right, okay.
You have the most phenomenal view here, looking down past the house. Such a relief that it's not actually teeming rain for once.
Well, I can't believe it's not teeming rain. You must have brought it with you. Yeah. Maybe better stay here for a wee while. we'd over 12 inches of rain there in October, and you just couldn't believe it. It was quite the wrong time of year, the devastation that caused, and a lot of our sort of, you know, in the better land further down, you know, and further east, where, you know, the loss of crop and everything was just horrendous, you know.
Yeah.
Absolutely horrendous.
Because after the harvest, a lot of farmers basically worked the land, sowed next year's crop, and a lot of that must have just been washed straight back out again.
Exactly. Yeah.
That is just phenomenal. Yeah. We're looking down the hill towards the river there, essentially, the River Tay. And there's still mist down in the bottom of the valley. It's a pretty calm day. Look at this, somebody's burning across there, and the smoke is rising practically vertically.
Yeah.
What a view. Yeah. Beautiful.
Yeah, it's good. It's good just now, but it's as you can see how steep the road is. Sometimes we know when it's it can be challenging getting up here even in the winter. Right. So we've just to be, it's great just now. It's quite mild. Hopefully we'll get some hard frosty weather, because like a lot of other farmers, we'll try to get dung out of sheds and things like that, and it's very difficult and challenging when it's wet.
You can hear that burn on our left hand side, and it is thundering there.
Yeah, it's a big burn, that one. That's the Dirtclick burn, and then the one across in the hollow, the Glassy burn. They come from two lochs out of the hill. And there's a serious amount of water goes down these, you know. And if you'd seen that in October, it was scary. Yeah.
I read one of your recent blogs, and you were talking about two of the big problems facing Scottish farming at the moment, in your estimation, is species management and river management. Yeah. What do you mean by river management?
So river management, up to about 30 years ago, we constantly did routine management of rivers. Farmers, local contractors, they all took, in fact, it was a lot of the, they had to do it. It was in the deeds of the land that they had. They had to maintain the river, because the river there, it's not only a natural resource, it's a natural and managed drainage system, you know, and for particularly protecting low arable land, particularly protecting houses and settlements where there's a lot of people living next to a floodplain, it was really important that we did that. And we've seen since, you know, a lot of regulations come in over the last 30 years that's actually stopped us doing that routine management. We can do a little bit of it now, but not near enough. And we're now starting to see the effect of that. We saw there in October that the record level of 1993 at Perth, it was only an inch off of that. Now, that, considering the amount of rain there was in 93 and the massive snowmelt, for that to have been the record level, just an inch off that level, shouldn't have happened.
There is a bridge in Perth. You can walk on one of the paths on the park. I'm 6'1", and you're looking way, way above you where the river actually was, and it was just an inch off that.
Just an inch off. So that the record level was 93, but that was off the back of a massive snowmelt that was, you know, comes down here. You've got to remember the Tay catchment, the watershed's Crean Larrick. You know, it's just 4,000 or 5,000 square kilometres, the catchment for the Tay. So for it to happen without that snowmelt just highlights the fact that we need to be going back into doing river management, and we're not doing enough of it. And it helps in so many fronts. You see islands appearing now in the rivers where they were never there before. They were not there 30 years ago. When you look between Perth and Dundee, that was always dredged back in the 40s, 50s and before, with three full-time dredgers taking Tay sand out of there. And that's not happening now. The harbour's now closed, and you think, really, we should be trying to get using more with boats and such like, and keep Perth Harbour alive, basically.
I've spoken to scientists. Now, obviously, hydrologists particularly, they don't like the idea of taking stuff out of rivers, etc. Because it canalises the river, it accelerates the flow, it causes problems further downstream. What's your position on that?
It won't cause issues further downstream if the same maintenance has happened further down the stream. So the issue we have now is because of the lack of maintenance over the last 30 years, it will take a fairly major operation to actually get this done. I think the technical term for some of them is hydromorphologists as well. Yes. And we had meetings with them down in Grantley Hall back in 2009 and 10, where we started saying, look, this is going to be a real issue if we don't address this. And we were told point blank that actually this is not the case. When you look over the last 20, 30 years of what's happening with the river, it's happening naturally. Taking the gravel out of the river won't actually make any effect to this. And that's the reason it's actually meandering and the river course is changing. The reason the river course is changing in many of these instances is because there's been islands and deposits being put in. This burn, for example, just now, the deposits that takes down and deposits that into the river, unless it's actually taken away further downstream and taken out, then it just builds up and builds up. If you've got a glass of water and it holds a pint, it holds 560 mils, and you put 100 mil of gravel in the bottom, it's only going to hold 468 mil of water. Now, it's not always just about the capacity, it's the flow, it's the speed of taking that away. So at that meeting in particular, there was actually some farmers that have lived beside the river and their families for generations, got up from that meeting and walked out. They were so disgusted because they knew and they understood how the rivers actually work. So, and I understand in some circumstances where these guys that are looking at this technically have some valid opinions, but the reality is without proper river management, it's just a choked drain that needs maintenance. And we've done that for generations. That's why we built the flood banks. What's going to happen in Perth in another 20 years? Are we going to have to raise that flood protection another 3 feet? Surely we're better taking that out of the bottom of the river. It keeps the river cleaner. It lets it flow cleaner. And now we're seeing that because the river's getting higher, it's having a bit greater impact on the banks as well. So there's a whole raft of reasons. I've got a photograph that I highlighted at our autumn conference in September of, in 1929, one of the driest years ever in the River Tay, and there was a woman, a picture of a woman standing on the gravel and only just managing to stand on the gravel. And yet in October, you could still see the gravel bed when the river was still high. You could still see where the gravel bed was below that. So the amount of gravel, we're talking tens of thousands, we're talking hundreds of thousands of tons that's been deposited over the last 30 years that we've not been allowed to take out. And I think we need to get back to that proper management. And this then all is not a cost to the taxpayer, because what's going to happen when it comes to further down the road again, and we have got situations where houses are flooded, what's the cost to that? If we're allowed to do the management we did up to about 30 years ago, that's done at no cost to the taxpayer.
Why is the legislation preventing you from doing that at the moment? What's the driver behind that?
So one of the things, I mean, I can remember actually, I was working with a contractor and a digger 30-odd years ago, and I remember being just below the bridge, Wade's Bridge in Aberfeldy, and we were taking gravel out for, and we use it for, and of course it's the best recycling you can actually use, because you're not taking it out an open quarry, or you're just using that, recycling that product. And we were stopped by some of the regulators that said we can't go in there because of the freshwater mussels. Now, the freshwater mussels were there. So the traditional management and river management that had happened for generations before that, the freshwater mussels just didn't arrive that day. And, oh, we've got to stop this. I mean, we've seen this time and time again. It's very similar to what we're trying to protect in the environment. And when you look at the Breadalbane ESA, the first environmental insensitive area in Scotland back in the early 80s, you know, we thought, this is fantastic. We've got a lot of plants and fauna we need to protect here. So you saw the classic, there's great orchids here, we need to protect that, let's fence it off. We did that, what happened? Everything else grew up, choked it all out. The only reason they were there in the first place was because of the management that was happening. And that is now getting recognised, how important grazing management is, and that's what allows that all to flourish. So we need to always not listen to the textbook stuff, we need to listen to experience as well, of people that's not just studied agriculture and the rural ways of life, but actually lived it for generations and actually really understand how it works. We're on a shooting estate here. We had French farmers here just a couple of months back, and we went up the hill and there was two goshawks, a couple of red kites and a buzzard that were picked up by them. You think, jings, that's, well, why are they here? That's natural environment for them. They're on a shooting estate. They've got easy prey, to be quite honest, when it comes to the game birds. Brings a lot of employment. We often don't get that message across, and it's very difficult.
Last time we spoke was at AgriScot, which is kind of a trade conference in Edinburgh, at Ingolston. You spoke, Marie Goujon, Cabinet Secretary for Rural Affairs, also spoke. Then it was open to the floor for questions. What really surprised me about that was, I think there was three or four farmers specifically mentioned beavers. Now, given what's going on in Scottish farming at the moment, I wouldn't have thought beavers would be very high on the list of priorities. Yeah, but clearly it was.
Well, absolutely. It's a massive issue. And I go back to one of our growers further east from here in 2018 or 19, I think it might have been, at a national conference in Edinburgh in February, said as far as he was concerned as an arable farmer, beavers was bigger than Brexit. And that's turning out to be the biggest issue.
That can't be the case, surely.
That's the case, Mark. When you on the 10th of October, you know, I went down to some of these farms where some of the flood banks had gone, and the burrows in the bank, it was absolutely colossal. Now, the reality was that the flood water down there, as it rose, I mean, these flood banks that have been there for hundreds of years, built to protect good arable land that can grow high-value crops, built for a reason and built for the right reason, a lot of these banks still had 2-3 feet to go before they overspilled. Now, if that happens, well, fair enough, that's happened. It's been a massive flood. But what was happening is these banks were blowing out when they still had 2-3 feet to go. And the reason they were blowing out is because they've been weakened and they're full of tunnels and channels all the way through the flood banks. You know, it's millions and millions of pounds worth of crop that's been lost that can be unharvested. Now, the reality is, when it comes to climate change, what's the situation going to be? Do we sort these flood banks? Does it happen again? Chances are it probably will if they're not taken out of there. And what do we do then? We've only got 8% of our land in Scotland as prime agricultural land that has the capability to grow that high-value veg. So do we just say, well, we can't grow it there anymore, let's import it? So do we import it from places like Portugal or Almeria, where we've got labour that is treated shockingly and they're using pesticides and growing their products in a different situation to what we're doing, and yet we're asked to jump through all these hoops all the time, and yet, well, we can't grow it here any longer, we'll just import it. Surely that's not a benefit to climate change.
Beavers have been introduced to several areas of Scotland deliberately, and the, you know, that was assessed beforehand. And on the whole, that seems to have worked quite well. It's different here in Tayside because there was a lot of illegal releases of beavers here. So, strictly speaking, they're not meant to be here.
No.
Just in terms of the legality of the situation, what do you want to happen here?
The reality of the situation is they should not be in areas where they have that conflict. Now, I understand in some circumstances where they may be beneficial, I'm still to be convinced of the fact that they will prevent flooding, because going back to farmers further up the valley here, again, talking about the catchment of the Tay, there's a massive arable belt from here all the way up to Lough Tay, which is about another 6-8 miles further up the road there. Back in 2006, I think it was, and 13, two big heavy rainfall issues where some folk were concerned about flooding. The reality was that a lot of the houses, farms, local settlements were not flooded, because although there was a significant amount of rainfall, the ground was all dry and took it in. So it probably took in the best part of maybe 3 inches of rain, because you had that ground was dry at the time. What happens if it's already saturated? So if you can imagine that whole valley area already saturated, and you get the 5-6 inches of rain again, it's got nowhere to go, and then it comes shooting down, and it's immediate. It's so fast. So holding back the water, I've still would be convinced that that's going to work, because I just think you've lost that sponge effect, the natural effect of the ground being able to take in a number of inches of water before it eventually has to run off. That's the best way to slow it down, is having that sponge effect of the ground.
The soil doesn't just act as a sponge for water, it also holds a lot of atmospheric carbon too.
Absolutely, it's a huge sink. I totally understand that. We're just at the beginning of January here, but you can still see how green things are, you know, remarkably green given the time of year. It's taking in, yeah. It's sequestering carbon out in the atmosphere. And that's because we've got a managed landscape that's doing that.
I could bore you just about how bad the weather's been over the last 2 or 3 yeah. weeks up in Aberdeen. I can't tell you what yeah. a pleasure it is to stand here in sunshine and look over that valley, and just a little light cloud and mist and smoke and things like that, and snow in the hills up there. Is the view better from further up?
Yes, I will have a look further up. It's fantastic. Yeah, we'll go and have a look further up the hill. We'll do that. Thank you, Matt.
You were saying that your father came to this farm for a start, and your daughter is working on the farm now.
Yeah.
Essentially, you are a farming dynasty now.
Yeah.
How easy is it for people to get started in farming in Scotland if they don't have that sort of family connection?
Yeah, I think it is challenging, and I think that was the good thing about the whole new entrance scheme and the Starter Farm Initiative. And that's kind of fallen by the wayside just now, and we're pushing the Scottish Government now to restart that, to get that going again, because it's a great opportunity. There's a lot of youngsters out there keen to get a start. And it's not all, we've always got to remember, it's not always about having to have your own farm. It's not always about having to be able to rent your own farm. It's actually getting into the industry as well. And there's great opportunities for working on farms. In fact, at the minute, it's actually a real challenge getting people. But there is people out there that are wanting to get their own start in it, because this is about keeping young families in rural communities, that keeps the whole environment, the whole social economic aspect alive as well, which is really important. We tend to forget about that, because this is about people as well. If you don't have people living and working in countryside, then it's a challenge, and we've got so many youngsters that want to get involved in it now.
Would it be possible to have thriving rural communities without agriculture?
No.
Why not?
Because you don't have the people, you don't have the whole community. One example is the local agricultural show. Now, it's by far the biggest and busiest week there is, our local show in Aberfeldy. Not a massive show, but it's by a long, long way the biggest week economic-wise for the town. And it's about, again, having that people that's involved in whatever happens in rural communities tends to evolve around people giving up their time. I mean, the shows are, you know, the amount it costs local farmers to put on a show is quite a considerable amount of money if you count your time. But we don't do that. You just do it for the area. You know, we don't do it for ourselves. You could think, jings, I could do something else this weekend. But no, that whole week you're involved in setting up a show, which is great.
We've come up onto, essentially, it's pretty close to being moorland, and you've got Highland cattle standing here amongst the heather, and we're actually just about into the cloud. It's very misty, very atmospheric, very, very Scottish.
Yeah, it is. Aye, absolutely. There's no doubt. It is pretty scenic, but they're not here for their scenic beauty. They're also here to do a job, you know, and they're here. The difference they make to this environment up here is tremendous. I mean, they put a lot of productivity back into the hill, because when they put dung back onto the ground, that's a massive help to all the wildlife, beetles, you know, bugs, everything that's going about, that helps then the other biodiversity. Probably why we've got so many lapwings, curlews and oyster catchers in this part of the world. So it's about livestock. They're so important for that. And they're also providing a fantastic source of nutritious protein, which is really, really important. We always tend to forget that, you know.
And this high up, there's still patches of snow. So we've spoken already about species management, river management, about how difficult it is to get started in the industry.
Yeah.
What are the other concerns of Scottish farmers at the moment?
One of the biggest concerns there is just now is about future policy. Policy direction is at the top of everybody's agenda. And also about the lack of recognition of what agriculture is all providing. Because it's not just about food production. It's about actually looking after the environment. And you can look around, it's beginning to clear a wee bit now. You know, you're looking at a managed environment there. That wouldn't be like that if it wasn't for agriculture. But that's why getting future policy right is so, so important for a whole raft of reasons, not just for farmers and crofters, it's also for the wider infrastructure that supports the food and drink industry throughout Scotland. You know, but something so, so fantastic in Scotland that we don't get the recognition for it just now. We're producing food in the sustainable manner we're doing. Yes, can we do more? Absolutely. There's no doubt we can do more, and we will be asked to do more. But unless we focus first and foremost, the support in future policies got to go targeted first and foremost to food production. If you deliver on that, you will deliver on the rest.
And your feeling is that that's not the drift at the moment?
I would say, no, I wouldn't say that's not the feeling at the moment. I think the reason we are so heavily involved with the Scottish Government is because we've got to get that message across. And we're seeing it in other parts of the UK just now. When you look at south of the border, where you have the Environmental Land Management Scheme, I've said that this has been a car crash for a long time. And I'll still stick with that because, yes, we have to do more for the environment. But we're now beginning to see a real worry with a lot of farmers south of the border on where that support's going. If they're not supported in the food production element, where is the critical mass of product going to be that's going to support the markets, the abattoirs, the food processors, the veg packers, that critical mass of product that's required to keep these, that wider infrastructure, the whole food and drink industry going? Where's it going to come from? It's not going to be there. So the whole infrastructure then begins to implode. So you have to do it in a managed situation. This just transition, as they're talking about. Yes, we can do more for the environment. So I think we're beginning to see some light at the end of the tunnel with the Scottish Government. It's taken a long time. You know, I'll hold my hand up. You'll know full well I get a lot of criticism for being involved that this is so slow. I've said often that I'd far rather we do this slowly, keep the whole industry on side, understanding that the support will be there provided we do some of the correct measures going forward and get it right, then rush into something that is, and it's still, when you see the amount of uptake of the ELMS and the Sustainable Farming Incentive south of the border, it's still woefully low. And I've got a real concerns that south of the border, we're going to see that drop in food production quite considerable. And given the fact that at the minute and throughout the whole of the UK, we're still only 60% self-sufficient, given what the global situation is just now, not only with climate change, we've got wars, we've got a whole disastrous situation in many aspects right across the globe, we need to focus and get our priorities right. Let's make sure that every country can feed themselves first. And Scotland is in a fantastic position to do that. Let us do it sustainably. Let us produce more. And we can not only help our own situation in terms of climate change, we can help other parts of the world as well.
During the Second World War, when we had a much, much, much smaller population, we couldn't feed ourselves as a country.
Yeah.
You're saying 60% at the moment. Could we ever hit 100%? How could we do that?
I don't think we can. I would very much doubt it. But I would hazard a guess, well, not a guess, probably an educated guess, that we could probably do nearer 80%. And that's a huge difference from where we are just now. Because at the minute, and again, this is where that's really frustrating, at the minute, because we're not anywhere close to 100%, we are importing. And we're importing, and this is such a devastating issue for especially our unsupported sectors, pigs and poultry. In particular, we're seeing eggs coming in from other parts of the world that don't have anywhere near the standards we do. We could produce more here. We can do that. We could produce far more pork. We've lost 20% of our pork production throughout the whole of the UK just now. We could produce a lot more easily, but we're not getting the returns to do it. And that's the reality. But the sad fact is we're still importing into the UK 40% of our pork production. Now, again, why are we doing that? Because retailers, as soon as the price starts to lift, they go into markets outside the UK and bring it in where labour's cheap, where the standards are not the same, where they're using pesticides, they're using treatments that we cannot use, and yet we're getting asked to do more and more. That's the part that needs to change, and that's why we're pushing so heavily on a change to the whole labelling situation we have at the minute.
How would you change it, though? Presumably, you don't want to use currently banned pesticides or things like that. You want to farm sustainably. So, how do you protect your market?
So I think one of the biggest things we can do is we need to start holding the retailers to account. Because at the minute, we're paying, throughout the UK, on an average, we're paying about 14% of our income on our food. Now, we're the lowest in Europe by a considerable amount. France is 19%. We're the lowest in Europe and we're the third lowest right across the globe. Now, that's a shocking statistic, given all the hoops that we're jumping through and the standards that we're actually proud of. We need to start holding the retailers to account, because every time they ask us to do more, we're doing more of these things to help make it so that we've got good products going into our shelves. But that benefit is not coming back to the primary producer. So we're getting squeezed all the time. It's constant. So we need to now hold them to account. So from a labelling point of view, we know our consumers. Any survey you do, our consumers will say, no, we trust our farmers. We'll probably trust our farmers more than many, many other parts of society, particularly politicians, being blunt about it. They will trust farmers all the road. But all too often, they're hoodwinked into thinking they're supporting our product, and they're not. The amount of times you go into any supermarket and you go down and you've got this commingling of product, or you're hoodwinked into, you see products that are badged up the same, packaged the same, look like a Scottish, and you take it home, you think, oh, this isn't actually. And I've seen it myself in well-known retailers where you've got product of Scotland in one bag, very, very similar packaging, product of Israel, and that was potatoes. And I thought, that's shocking. And a retailer keep talking about supporting Scottish and UK produce. So there's a simple answer to this, and it will take a long time. And they're talking about it actually today at the Oxford Farming Conference. I've heard Steve Barclay's been mentioning it. And I've raised this with the other unions throughout the UK as well. What we need to have is a labelling system that's very, very simple. Now, labelling's so complex in the legislation that's around it. That's not for us to worry about the complications around it. That's for government to sort it out, because this is about informing the consumer, not telling them not to buy a product, but telling them what's actually in it. And all we want is a very, very simple label that has to be a minimum of 5% the size of the packaging, that simply states on it, more than 50% of this product is from outside the UK. Now, to me, red is always, you know, whether it's traffic lights or whatever it is, red is always danger. Now, it's not telling people not to buy it, it's just informing them, all right, so they get that choice immediately. The big advantage of doing something like this is through the food service sector, because a third of our consumption is through food service. But nobody ever asks where it comes from. You could put that on the menus. You could put that on the menus on the product so people can see immediately, so that they know, that's a Scottish or a UK product. That's tremendous. I'll go for it. And it means that then it holds retailers to account. We're having a Good Food Nation Act in Scotland. There will be a Good Food Nation Plan. What's the retailer's plan to tie into that Good Food Nation Act? Here's an opportunity for them, if they want to put their money or their actions where their mouth is and actually support what's happening in Scotland to the UK. If they don't, they risk losing what we've already got, and that's the biggest concern.
We've spoken about a whole heap of stuff here, and effectively, I think we've probably scratched the surface of the issues facing Scottish farming at the moment. What's the upside of this? Because it's not easy, and there are very few definite, you know, things in the future. You just don't know what's happening. You know, you're not in control of your own markets. All sorts of things argue against doing this. Why do you farm?
Because I love doing what I'm doing. I don't think there's a better industry in the world. I really don't. It's actually the only industry we cannot do without. Now, you can look at anything. Oh, we can't do without oil. We can't do without... Well, we actually can. But historically, this is the only industry nobody can do without. So if the lights go out, the heating goes off, well, yeah, it's tough, yeah. But if you try and take food away from us, that's... And you look at issues across the globe, we're seeing it at the minute where, you know, food's been weaponized almost. We saw it with energy. Why did it happen? We took our eye off the ball in sustainable energy and having it ourselves, and we relied on others to provide it for us. If we provide it for ourselves, surely a country's first priority is to feed its nation, first and foremost. The rest comes second. The reason I farm is because I think there is huge opportunity. I'm an eternal optimist. I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing if I wasn't an optimist, because I do think there's a fantastic future for Scottish agriculture in particular going forward, and we're in pole position. Look at the research institutes we have in Scotland. We need to get governments to understand about gene editing. Let our research institutes develop new plants that are drought resistant, disease resistant, all these things that we can help other parts of the world. So Scotland for me is probably one of the best opportunities for food production and development and innovation there is in the world. That's why I'm optimistic. See her just now, there's Katrina coming up the hill there with the trailer with three Highland heifers that are now coming in here. The reason that I'm optimistic is I've got a next generation coming on that are so keen to continue doing this, and that's probably one of the biggest drivers I've got doing what I'm doing just now.
Martin Kennedy, farmer and president of the National Farmers Union in Scotland. Loads of food for thought there. If you've got any views on any of what you've heard, please do get in touch. You can email us at outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. Until the next podcast, I'm Mark Stephen. Thanks for listening.